Welcome to another edition, I guess we can call it, of long COVID and chronic fatigue. We are doing this to let people know the possibilities, and how they can maybe help themselves and help direct the physicians they're seeing, give them some ideas. As you have heard me say many times, I'm really appreciative of the work that the government is doing on research. I just feel that the treatments that the government-sponsored long COVID clinics don't offer much for people. And those of us who've been treating chronic fatigue and chronic Lyme and any other chronic illness, really all the autoimmune diseases, we understand this is a problem of chronic inflammation, and you usually get here through your environment and your genes. And today, I have a real pleasure of talking with Dr. Kevin Connors of the Connors Clinic in Somerset, Wisconsin. And Dr. Connors has done some really good work on understanding how our genes affect these most important systems of detox and inflammation. And I hope that you're going to get information that you can use and help you on your healing journey. This is a big subject. So, Dr. Connors, I would love to start off with talking about, which I think is probably, in my mind, one of the basis of chronic illness is the failure to detox and how you approach this and what you've seen.
So I agree with you. Failure to get out what's on the inside that your body's trying to deal with that you've been exposed to, either through poisons in the air that you breathe in or that you ingest, or endotoxins from viruses and bacteria as they are trying to survive in your body or dying in your body, and your immune system and your detoxification pathways have to deal with. So how do you deal with detoxification? Well, that's a big question. I actually wrote a book on it called The Seven Phases of Detoxification, but I think in this a little episode we're going to talk about really the liver detoxification pathways and how issues from a genetic standpoint can play into that, because that's what can really limit a person's rate. So when we talk about detoxification, it's really about you have to be able to get rid of poisons faster than you are taking in poison. So you could say maybe your rate of detoxification has to exceed your rate of toxification. That's not really a word, but let's make one up. So as you're becoming more toxic because of environmental things that you're exposed to from various, maybe a myriad of possible exposure sources, you have to get rid of these things. So if you're detoxification rate is slower than your exposure, you're going to become sicker because these things, are going to circulate through your body, and then they're going to just be pushed into the extracellular spaces, and then they can cross cell membranes and be stored within the cells, and it could cause, much worse conditions, because if it affects the nucleus and can damage the DNA replication cycle, then it is the cause of cancer. If it just stays in the extracellular spaces and clogs things up, doesn't allow, waste to move out, you're just going to, be sick. Depending on what organ is involved, you could develop antibodies against that organ as your immune system is trying to help with the detoxification process, which it's not supposed to. You could develop antibodies to an organ, and that's called an autoimmune disease. So worse things can happen as you become more toxic. So the idea is you want to try to increase the rate of detoxification. So as we look at it, and how I would look at it is that, okay, well then, most people go, okay, well, I want to pull stuff out of the tissue then and get it out of my body. But if you pull stuff out of the tissue faster than your liver can process it, we have a problem. It's just going to circulate around in the blood again and be deposited somewhere else. So those rates of detoxification pathways in the liver are very important, and those can somewhat be monitored through looking at a person's genetics. So there are specific genes for phase one detoxification pathways and specific genes for phase two detoxification pathways. Those are the main detoxification pathways in the liver. So if we look at a person's genetics and we look at their cytochrome P450 genes, we could get some clues to the rate of that pathway. We look at their PON1 or their NAT genes, that's the phase two pathways, then we can get an idea of how fast that's going to go through. It's not a perfect system, but you get some ideas on how to support that patient where they may be having some damming of the flow of poisons out of their body.
Can you give us some, you mentioned the PON1 and the NAT and the cytochrome P450. Are there particular, or the most common bad actors, if you will, or things that people should, be aware of? Because many, many people have gotten, their genetics done, but often they're left looking at a lot of data they don't know what to do with.
Yeah. So it's really hard. There's a lot of research on these different pathways and some on specific genes in those families of genes, because like the cytochrome P450 genes, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of those genes, right? So really you kind of have to look at when we look at somebody's genes, we look at, okay, here's the cytochrome P450 family. How many single allele or double allele defects do they have in that family? If they have a lot, then that could be an issue. Or if they have defects on genes that are uncommon to have defects, some genes in the gene families, it's like super common to have a double allele defect on this, like 90-some% of the people have a double, then you would be less concerned about that. But if only 4% have a double allele defect on this specific gene and you have that, that raises some questions that this could be a bad actor that could be slowing this person's pathway down. So there's the way to look at it, at least in my perspective, is how many defects do they have in that entire family? And then secondly, are some of their defects oddball defects, meaning that they're uncommon defects? That could mean that it's given another clue that that could be a bad actor that could be hindering it. Now we have to say that you don't treat the defect and just because a person has a defect doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be dysfunction there. But as we reason together, then we can say, well, this could be an issue. This might be a pathway that it would be wise to support. So that's really what the research shows. You don't treat a defect. You can't fix a defect. It is there. How did they get the defect? It could be acquired through exposure to a toxin themselves, or it could be inherited from, their parents. We wouldn't know unless we would have had a genetic test on that person when they were 6, and now we look at them when they're 60 to see if there's a difference, but nobody has that data.
Right. Yeah, I just want to emphasize for people how important it is to look at the frequency of the allele, the frequency of the gene that is different from what we expect. If it's at the 50% level, there's probably something about it that had some survival benefit along the way. It's the 20 to 30% that you start thinking about. And as you said, if it's 4%, you really got to wonder, this could be something that an area that really needs support. So I just think that's an important point for people to keep in mind, because too many people see a defect and they think they're doomed. And something we'll talk about when we get to the methylation genes.
Yeah.
You know, so and as far as the you know your basic so your work, well, I guess what would be is there any, you know, one or two genes that in the liver pathways that you see that need to support more often, you know, like a more common group of them?
Well, definitely the PON1 pathway genes, I would say, are more commonly an issue, at least with our, you know, member base. That's kind of what we see. I mean, we see, you know, a large part people that are diagnosed with cancer. So, and then you go, okay, well, there's a cause to cancer. What's the cause to cancer? Well, most commonly, it's some sort of toxin that gets inside the cell that affects the nucleus and affects the replication pathway. And then you go, okay, what's the main way you get rid of certain toxins? Well, the PON1 pathway is the main way that you get rid of pesticides and herbicides, a major cause of cancer. So so that's what we tend to see most in our member base because of who we're seeing. So it is a little different, and there is some data for people with chronic Lyme. So there's different data that can be extrapolated, you know, once you know what a person's, you know, diagnosis is. You know, there has been some research done on some different conditions. But definitely what we see is that PON1 pathway, inability to get rid of pesticides and herbicides in a proper manner or proper rate, can leave them in the body and then harbor in the cell.
Yeah, no, and that's something that we also see, because I think the issue of pesticide herbicide buildup leading to chronic inflammation is a huge problem. So that's, and you know, I really you know, we always come down to it that the difference between the person, I think, with any chronic illness is often failure to either overexposure, but more often is failure to detox what we're all exposed to, though our environment has changed dramatically. So let's move on to the histamine genes, because those are ones that is a special interest in long COVID, since so many of the people do have issue who develop long COVID find that they have coincident problems now with mast cell activation, where, you know, maybe before they had just an allergy or a rash now and then, but after COVID, this becomes a major problem for them.
Yeah, I would agree. That's so common with long COVID type symptoms, is they have this ramped up inflammation that's a histamine like mast cell activation. So you got to go look at the histamine genes, and you go, wow, is there a correlation? Are these people that are suffering with long haul COVID, is it at least in part due to, you know, they have a lot more defects in their HNMT genes, how they would get rid of histamine in the tissue, or the DAO genes, how they would get rid of histamine in the gut and inflammation in the gut. So it's more complex than just that, for sure. But if a person has those defects, again, the inability to get rid of or calm down that histamine response is huge. It's at least a fairly large part of many of these people's symptoms. So supporting that as best you can is wise. The difficult part is that it's not easy to support that. So certainly it's much easier to support that in the gut. If it's the DAO gene that has defects that's making the DAO enzyme in the gut, you can give a DAO enzyme, but you don't absorb that enzyme. So you can at least calm down that inflammation in the gut. And as you know, so much of our systemic inflammation starts in the gut. So if we have food sensitivities that are not being addressed, we're already ramping up inflammation, and histamine is going to be a part of that inflammatory process. So you have to address food sensitivities, because people don't know they even have them. So getting a good, you know, lab done where you're looking at those and looking at peptides of foods, not just the whole protein, would be wise to look at. Looking at their genes and their DAO defects, and supporting that with taking a DAO enzyme, even between meals, where you're calming down that inflammatory process that's always ramped up, a person can then decrease their systemic inflammation from there. And then how do you deal with, you know, the HNMT gene defects, where how you make the DAO enzyme in the tissue? Then you're getting into all the anti-inflammatory and antihistamine type nutrients, which some people respond to better than others. It's just as simple as that. It's just not an easy fix.
Yes, you know, it's not an easy fix is a good way to describe it. You know, for people, and we're going to have some discussions just about MCAS and mast cell activation in going into detail. But I think that, again, one point that we always have to remind people is the mast cells are just a primitive part of your immune system, or that they affect everything, every component. And, you know, knowing that you have the HNMT, the defect in the methyltransferase to get rid of histamine is really important. And then the other genetic issue, which a lot of people are aware of, is methylation. In fact, as we were talking before we began to record, I think some of the misunderstanding of the genes around methylation really confuse people and probably sometimes create too much fear. You know, people have this idea that, you know, if they have MTHFR, they're doomed. I just remind them that there are many populations that have a 50% penetrance of that gene. So it's not quite so black and white. But I'd love you to give a little overview of, you know, the other components of that pathway that people should be thinking about, and just some of the caveats on the supplementation that can get them into trouble.
Yeah, well, we've seen so many people get into trouble because they'll contact us and go, oh my gosh, I have a double allele defect of my MTHFR 677. I'm going to die tomorrow. And that is far from the truth. Matter of fact, there you can live a long, happy life and never have any issues from that. And that's true for any of the genes. It's not the gene, it's the epigenetic environmental things that are going on that affect that gene. The worst thing I think that a person could do is look at a gene like the MTHFR gene and then go, oh, I have the need for a methyl group, so I need to start taking methyl tetrahydrofolate or methyl cobalamine. That makes sense because I have a defect. Well, it just doesn't always work that way. Matter of fact, two people can respond differently with a defect. You could have a defect and your pathway actually goes faster. I could have a defect and it actually slows the pathway. So that's why I always say genes leave clues. That's all they are. They're just clues. You have to put it together with the entire history of the person, what symptom patterns they have going on. I'll give you, for instance, a person can have an MTHFR defect, go to a practitioner that maybe is not fully informed about what we're talking about. And then, you know, or they self-apply, you know, methyl tetrahydrofolate. They start taking a gram or two a day of this or more. And what that does is that can push a different pathway. So when you take supplements, you have to be careful because you are affecting metabolic pathways, and you can affect it in a way that you don't want to affect it. Too much methyl groups can do harm to a person. So I'll give you a, for instance, with our cancer members, we don't want them to take excess methyl groups, even if they have defects in the MTHFR gene or any other of the methylation pathway genes, because what do methyl groups do? You need methyl groups. They help silence genes. They turn them off. But if you have a diagnosis of cancer, we don't want to risk having excess methyl groups and silencing tumor suppressor genes. Tumor suppressor genes are supposed to be, quote unquote, turned on when you have a cancer to stimulate apoptosis of that cell. If we're consuming excess methyl groups, we could, you know, theoretically silence our tumor suppressor genes, even though we might not have any defects in our P53 pathway or our BRCA pathway, we could be turning those off. So we don't want to do that. Plus, we have our patients consuming good folate by eating, you know, green leafy vegetables already. Taking a supplement with excess methyl groups could easily be in an overmethylation state and produce that. Another example for somebody who doesn't have cancer, I have an MTHFR defect, so I have to take methyl tetrahydrofolate. That's my problem. That will solve my problem. By taking extra methyl groups, we will push the biopterin pathway harder. When we push the biopterin pathway harder, we could end up with excess serotonin levels, excess dopamine levels, and then end up with complicating factors there. I'll give you an example. I've had patients that, you know, knew that maybe they did a genetic workup and they, you know, it's not as common now, but years ago, people would only maybe get, you know, 10 or 15 genes tested. One of them was the MTHFR gene because all the snafu was about that. They saw that they had a defect, started taking methyl groups, push the biopterin pathway, which is where you make all your neurotransmitters, and then they ended up with excess serotonin. Well, you think, oh, that's the happy, you know, hormone, right? Happy neurotransmitter. Well, in excess, it can make you be very rageful, especially if you have MAO-A defects. It can increase rage and anger. So it can produce things that you don't want to produce. So you want to take as broad of a view of genetics as you possibly can before you start supplementing based upon specific genetic defects.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point that the body does not, is I always say, it's more of a bag of soup than it is a bunch of Lego toys. You know, I mean, like the connections are myriad and not linear. So we have to be careful. What about, I mean, one of the areas that a lot of people are interested in is just, you know, in this area of methylation genes, is the difference between the different types of B12 and the different types of folate. Just can you sort of illuminate that a little bit?
So the different types of B12 are, you know, there's really four main types. Cyanocobalamin, which is more synthetic. We don't recommend that for anybody. Then there's hydroxycobalamin and adenosylcobalamin. For our member base, that's what we recommend. And then there's methylcobalamin. So usually a person does fine with taking some methylcobalamin, but if they're taking methylcobalamin, so cobalamin is the B12 component. It has to be attached to something. That's the way it's chelated. If it's chelated to a methyl group, then that will become a methyl donor, a C carbon group with three hydrogens on it. That's a methyl group. That will become a methyl donor in the bloodstream. And the thought process was, if I have an MTHFR defect, I should be taking methylcobalamin because I need more methyl groups, because that's what helps process the methylation pathway. That's the end product of the methylation pathway. Same thing with 5-tetrahydrofolate supplements on the market. That's the end product of the MTHFR gene. So if I have defects, the thought process was, boy, I need more of that. Well, again, we have to be careful not to make the mistake to treat the defect by looking back upstream from 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, giving folate in a natural form of folate. Never give folic acid. That's a synthetic folate. Does not work the same way, could actually cause damage to the body. Matter of fact, some have theorized that can actually cause damage to the MTHFR gene. And maybe why we have so many people with MTHFR gene defects is because the addition of folic acid to bread back in the 50s in America. So folic acid is synthetic. You don't want to use that. But a folate, a calcium folate, might be a better idea, or maybe just start eating more green leafy vegetables. So we get naturally occurring folate that has synergistic other nutrients that we don't even know about yet. So always it's best to get our nutrients through our food if possible. So maybe that's a better way. But at least you want to take a step back and look, okay, if I push this pathway, where is it going to go ultimately? I need to know what's downstream. So you need to look at that. And like you just said, which was brilliant, it's not just as linear as that graph goes either. So if I add methyl tetrahydrofolate, is that just going to now push the methionine pathway? Well, no, because it's more like soup. Everything is connected. These specific metabolic components affect other processes in your body. And you're adding fuel to something possibly that you don't want to add fuel to.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about how this affects the SAMe and how that can affect dopamine and just energy in general?
Well, SAMe is part of the methionine pathway, and it's necessary for energy and such, like you said. But it's also connected then through the biopterin pathway, and that affects all the neurotransmitters, serotonin and dopamine and glutamate. And then you have, it just gets very complex. So when you look at somebody's genes, for instance, when we're looking at a person who has a diagnosis of cancer, one of the genes we want to look at is the glutamate genes, because those are to be important, because glutamine can be, it is common to be a major feeder for cancer. So can methionine. So that pathway is important. You don't want to push excess methionine and excess glutamine, because you can basically be creating fuel for a growing cancer. So you have to be careful with those pathways. Specific defects in the glutamine pathway can accelerate glutamine's transfer to glutamate as well, and that affects brain issues. So if you don't have cancer, it can increase the amount of glutamate in the brain, and glutamate is a neurotransmitter in the brain, and it's an excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain. And it's how many people have OCD issues, anxiety issues. Most of them, at least have a component of excess glutamate in the picture for those people.
Yeah, so I think you made a very good point. When we first started going down the rabbit hole of genetics many years ago, we really thought we had the answer to many diseases. And of course, it's turned out that other than cancers, which often involve a change in the gene of 1, 2, 3, 5 genes, when we deal with chronic inflammation and chronic fatigue and now long COVID, we're dealing with a multitude of interacting genes. And just, when it comes to the glutamate pathway, we always have to be very delicate, because a lot of our chronically inflamed patients, the glutamate will really cause a problem. Very careful with them. And so as you've studied, because I said what I've been impressed with is how, your deep understanding of these pathways and especially the connection to the BH4, because to make my point is that all these are involved with inflammation, which is what's going to trigger fatigue on some level. When you're inflamed, your body's response to inflammation, along with it is fatigue. So are there any particular tips you can give to people that you think are safer to stick their toe in the water as they try supplements?
I would say so, especially given fatigue and with chronic disease and like long haul type symptoms. It's often brain fatigue. It's often brain inflammation, I should say. So now brain inflammation has some components of genetics to it, but more components of environmental. So anything that crosses the blood-brain barrier, that shouldn't cross the blood-brain barrier, your brain has to deal with it. Meaning, like if it's a virus, or if it's some sort of toxin, whatever it is, your brain has to deal with it. And you have certain cells in the brain, the cells that make up the blood-brain barrier, or the astrocytes, and then you have certain cells in the brain that are your immune cells in the brain. Those are your microglial cells. So the microglial cells would be equivalent to, in your rest of your body, kind of like your macrophages that go, that circulate around and engulf bacterium, right? And then they dissolve it, and that's called phagocytosis, and it just eats up that bacteria. Well, that's what your microglial cells do in the brain. But when you, and they, with toxins, it actually grabs onto them and brings them over and gets rid of them to the bloodstream and gets rid of the toxin. So they circulate around, these microglial cells. But the bad thing that can happen with chronic infection, with you know, toxins that enter into the brain in excess, with brain damage because of trauma, brain physical trauma, like football players and such. And a lot of this research has come out of all the money that's been poured into brain research with post-concussive syndrome, that these microglial cells get damaged. And that's what's called a primed microglial cell. And then they can sit and not be as mobile as before. So instead of traveling around the brain looking for bad guys to engulf or to drag out of there and get rid of, they just kind of sit there. And then they can move into a worse state. So they're called primed microglial cells. And then they can move into a worse state, and they can actually be an inflammatory cell. So they are literally spewing out inflammatory chemicals called cytokines. So that's where a person really has post-concussive syndrome. That's where a person can have really bad symptoms with chronic Lyme issues, or long haul symptoms where they just have a lot of brain fog. They just can't, they just don't feel right. They have a lot of fatigue. They can't get out of bed. They can't think straight. You know that you have inflammation in the brain. So what are some hints to do with this? Well, the beauty of all this research coming out of post-concussive is we have details that is not really supporting what they wanted to support. They wanted to find a drug that was going to take care of this. And they found that steroids, which would be the normal thing that drug-wise that you'd give a person with inflammation in the brain, don't tend to actually help these primed glial cells, these primed microglial cells. They can actually make it worse. So what they found is that it is natural things that will actually calm down those primed microglial cells. And these are things that any natural doctor would think of first for inflammatory processes. They're like the curcumin, the flavonoid type families, the curcumin, the boswellia, the white willow bark, the stinging nettle, the EGCG from green tea extract, the resveratrol. Those are the things that can help calm down the inflammation of the brain. That those people are pretty safe to take. They tend to be less have less allergy issues with them, but they could be just a lifesaver for these people. You have to take fairly high dose, and you have to go slow and ramping them up, but calming down that inflammatory process in the brain can give a person their life back. And you know, there's other things that you have to be careful of that will ramp that up. Like alcohol, they found, is one of the worst things you could do with a person that has primed microglial cells. Overexercise. I mean, people think they're going to continue to work out like they did when they were 20 years old, can ramp up primed microglial cells and ramp up the inflammation of the brain. Further head traumas are pretty commonsensical, and further toxin exposure is pretty commonsensical. So anything you do to help heal the blood-brain barrier and calm down those primed microglial cells, it fits back to the flavonoid families.
Yes, it's the you know, and I think that's where the toxins come in as well, because that it's the signals from the body, as we say, from the periphery, that get into the brain that are causing a lot of these problems. And this is where I said that circle of your detox genes and your histamine genes and your methylation genes all are coming together. And that's where I think, as you've mentioned, the herbs should be our first step, our first choice, because they generally, I like to think they co-evolved with us, so less chance that they're going to make a mess when we're trying to fix things. You know, we sometimes think we're smarter than we are. But and so what about one of the things that's always intrigued me is the whole the BH4 pathways and how important tetrabiopterin is. And do you have any particular ways that you work with that directly, or is it anything that you have found to be really helpful when people have imbalance in that pathway?
There's not one thing for sure. Everybody's different, and with any issues with the biopterin pathway, when you're looking at those gene defects, that's where, especially with the biopterin pathway, you have to go back to the patient's symptomatology. It's kind of like dealing with the low thyroid. You could do a blood workup and it tells us, oh, we have, you know, Hashimoto's, but it doesn't tell us the dosage that we should be on in either supplementing it. Same thing with the biopterin pathway. Oh, we have, let's say, you know, issues with serotonin. They're very low because of these MAOA defects, maybe, but we got to look at the patient's symptoms. They have clinical depression. Well, then you want to maybe support that pathway in a certain way. But again, too high of serotonin can be equally problematic. So you really got to balance it based upon the person's symptoms, not based upon their genetics.
Yeah. You keep coming back to, I think the essence of medicine has always been the history. You know, we all want to find, I mean, I must say I've spent a large part of my career searching for the tests that are going to give me the answers, but it's that history that really guides us. You know, we especially coming from medicine, where we think that way. Oh, we're going to find the one cause and we're going to fix it, and is just not what happens. So when you tie these things together, when you're looking at it at a genetic report, are there groups that stand out for you that, you know, especially with the fatigued patients, since that's really that's such a big part of the long haul COVID is fatigue. Is there an overview that you, or just a way you think about it?
Well, first of all, I'd say you can't just look at the genetics. You can't. That's only a piece. So, but if you're going to just analyze genetics on this person or just separate that out and say, what do you most commonly see? It's really the detoxification genes. And supporting detoxification is going to be the most important from a genetic perspective. But you have to look at the inflammation in the body that is coming from other sources that are beyond the genetics. So we touched on food sensitivities, we touched on brain inflammation. And if you don't take, as a practitioner, if you don't take that multifaceted approach to a person's healthcare, you're going to have more limited results. So you have to look at as many different facets as possible. And even at that, the more you do, you're still not talking about a cure. You're talking about better manage. I always find it, you know, scary when I see a practitioner say, we cure autoimmune disease. Are you crazy? Nobody cures autoimmune disease. You can better manage autoimmune disease and teach a patient how to better manage their autoimmune condition. We don't talk about cure. We talk about, you know, improving a person's life, especially when you're talking about cancer or chronic Lyme. These are serious conditions where there's a lot of tissue damage and there's things that you just can't erase. So you're talking about learning how to manage it. And the more the more pieces to the puzzle, maybe that's a better metaphor, that you can put together for a person, the better results and outcome that they're going to have. But so much of it is the patient's responsibility. You're just kind of putting the pieces together and showing them. Then the patient has to do the work. And not everybody's tuned to that, you know. The ones that are, and the ones that will take responsibility for what they have going on, instead of just, you know, wanting to put a rubber stamp on their forehead, I have Lyme or I have long haul, and that's the reason why I have problems. If you're willing to not be a victim, you're going to have better outcomes.
It's a pleasure to speak to someone whose focus of thought is often, you know, around genetics. So you've done a lot of deep work in it to really still hold the whole system. You know, there are many people out there who think they're going to support a few gene pathways and bring people back to perfect health. Again, simple things work when people have mild illnesses, you know, and I think that's why the good news for people is that many people with long COVID, their body is going to repair the damage and eventually quiet down the inflammation. It's the folks who carry a significant toxicant burden or have underlying infections that before this, their body was keeping under control that are now going to be in trouble. Are there particular pathways that you've looked at or stood out for you in the people with the, you know, chronic fatigue and chronic Lyme? And the reason I bring them up is, in my mind, those are probably the biggest overlap with what we're seeing with long haul COVID.
Yeah, I'd go back to the detox genes for sure. So you hit the nail on the head, is that these people, even before they had chronic Lyme or before they had long haul COVID, their body was just kind of limping along. You know, they had a toxic load that was just at that precipice of overflow and causing issues. And then this was the straw that broke the camel's back, per se. So you have to take this apart piece by piece and start, you know, trying to get rid of that toxic load, improve that person's rate of detoxification every which way you can.
Yes, it's one of the it is frustrating because those of us, I said, who started off in the magic world of medicine where, you know, you give the drug and the patient recovers, you know, I call it the magic world because it is kind of magical thinking, because it works with a few illnesses. And sometimes we do such great things with acute trauma that we forget that it really depends on the healing process. And that is where the toxins begin to interfere in preventing the healing process. But, you know, I'm going to go back one more time to just an area that I'm looking for information from you, you know, because the BH4 issue, because, you know, like with I stay interested in it for people with long COVID is, you know, one of the big risk factors for severe COVID is any type of glucose intolerance, you know, diabetes especially, but even just the kind of glucose intolerance that most people aren't aware they have, you know, with excess insulin levels. And that seems to be, you know, a system that's very sensitive to BH4 and vasodilatation and enough nitric oxide. So any pearls in that area?
Well, there's... it's not exactly the BH4 pathway, but you want to look at the HIV-1 pathway too, because that's how, as you talk about glucose levels, as glucose goes through glycolysis, it ends up with lactic acid, right? And then it changes to pyruvate, two pyruvates, and then it goes into acetyl coenzyme A, the Krebs cycle. A dependent gene in there is your HIV-1 gene, and that gene with defects can push things to lactic acid and not be able to get into the Krebs cycle where you efficiently make energy is with the Krebs cycle. So the idea with glycolysis, if you remember, you know, the listeners remember their biology from high school, is that you're making ATP. And then you go into the Krebs cycle, and that's when you really kick out ATP. So you take glucose, break it down through glycolysis, and then it goes into the Krebs cycle through acetyl coenzyme A, and you really make energy. So one of the issues is with gene defects that don't allow glucose to go all the way into the Krebs cycle is you can end up, your body could be feeding off of lactic acid, and you could produce more lactic acid. That is in effect for cancer patients, the Warburg effect. So the Warburg effect is that their cancer cells are feeding off of lactic acid and making energy only through glycolysis, which is very inefficient, but it's faster. So that's how the cancer is functioning anaerobically. But a person without cancer can end up experiencing that same situation, but their symptom is just it's not the cancer cell doing that, it's all your cells that are functioning, or majority of your cells are functioning more in that way. And then you're not producing the ATP, the energy for that cell to function. And that can be a key component to fatigue. And that can also back up the whole system and thereby raise the glucose levels in the blood, because glucose is basically downstream blocked at the endpoint of glycolysis.
Well, that gives us food for thought in how we try to deal with these people and realizing, normalizing that pathway. And that's a pathway for people who've listened to other parts of our summits over the years. We often talk about the cell danger response, which breaks up, kind of understands inflammation in a three-step process. And part of that is what we call the CDR2 is when you're healing, you are using Warburg metabolism in CDR2 in order to rebuild tissue, just like cancer cells, except the difference is that those cells are still listening to the stop signals and they're not continuing. They're healing the wound or repairing the tissue, growing back where tissue has been damaged. And how important that these pathways that are useful for healing, but once we can't turn them off, become a source of illness. And that's basically, in my little worldview, the story of chronic illness is that the failure to turn off an otherwise useful pathway, but it just gets stuck. It just gets stuck on. So to wrap up in your world of, I shouldn't say your world, but I say that cause I'm excited to learn more. I mean, we haven't gone deep enough into how you look at a lot of these genes. Cause I said, I've been looking at them for years, but I don't think I've used them, I think, more superficially. And it's just, is there, a way for patients to get more information about what it is that you do?
They could go to our website, connersclinic.com, C-O-N-N-E-R-S clinic. We have, I found it that it's hard to take on, pay more patients and members than we can. So we've actually created some courses, and we've been mainly talking about genetics. I have a Read Your Genes course, where I like to teach, so I like to put things on video format, and the more I can educate on video, then I don't have to explain the same thing to 500 different people. So through the course, you can watch all my videos on genetics and how we would look at a genetic overview, and you can do a genetic review with us as well if a person wants to. So there's different ways to connect with us and not actually become a member, but you can become a course member and take our courses. So we try to, we see ourselves as a ministry. We believe that, God gives this information. It's my responsibility to convey that to other people. And we try to do that as cost efficient as possible to people. So,
well, That is a wonderful thing, especially, you know, there are many people who are ill and feel powerless. It's nice to the information that you're giving them. It will help give them the power to begin to take care of themselves. And as you said, that is what's so important for recovery and to regain your health, is to feel empowered and that you're not a victim. I mean, it's, you know, we all have bad things happen to us. And it's nice to remember that there's people like you out there supplying the information that you can begin to empower yourself, and also educate your doctors. Because that, you know, and if your doctor doesn't want to listen to you, you should probably find another doctor. You know, I often say I've learned a tremendous amount from all the hours that patients spend online. And I think it's something that should be celebrated and not ignored, as many in the conventional world do, but, you know, in the empowerment. And yeah, so thank you. And I thank you for your work. Thank you for this time. And I really encourage people to take a look at their genes. And if they have the time to really, you know, get through your courses, and they can come back to the doctor with information. And then in partnership, they can really probably help move themselves along. So yes. Thank you again.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.